Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for more traditional exercise such as weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447. Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
It's Wednesday, May 14th, 2014, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and along here with me are Missouri School of Journalism colleagues Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, the Associated Press and Reuters tells reporters to keep it brief, shorten their stories to ease the burden on overworked copy editors. A study published in the Journal of the American Medical Association's Internal Medicine Journal shows journalists do a lousy job of reporting on health and fitness issues. And after more than 50 years on the job, Barbara Walters is retiring this week. I'll ask our panel about the legacy she'll leave behind. There's a lot more I'm hoping we'll get to as well before the top of the hour, but let's start with this weekend's NFL draft. There were plenty of storylines to follow, but most eyes in our area were peeled for news of what would be for Michael Sam. Finally, that came late Saturday afternoon when we learned that the St. Louis Rams used their seventh-round pick to take the SEC Defensive Player of the Year. This is what it sounded like on the ESPN broadcast.
This is the moment where Michael Sam got the news that he is going to be a member of the St. Louis Rams. There you see him on the phone, and there you see the raw emotion. We've seen this so many times, over and over again, for so many players.
ESPN then held that shot. Our TV and internet audiences are still looking at it for more than a minute. If you haven't seen it, it was kind of sweet to watch. You could see how overcame emotion, with emotion Sam was in that moment. He doubled over at one point, barely able to stand as he listened to Rams head coach Jeff Fisher tell him the news. It continues. People who are watching it online or on TV with us are seeing right now he's being hugged, completely bent over at the waist, holding the phone and visibly sobbing as he's just hearing the news, hearing that he is in line to become a new member of the St. Louis Rams. It continues to go on. We're still watching it here in the studio. Sam then hangs up the phone, reaches for his boyfriend, gives him a kiss there, and then a warm embrace. There was a lot of reaction to that being aired, both good and bad.
Yeah, I mean, and most of it, I will say, and remarkably so, if you'd had this same event happen 5-10 years ago, you probably would have had a somewhat different reaction, mostly positive, both in terms of the journalistic coverage, in terms of social media. There were some folks out there who were saying some hateful things, but for the most part, the nation's and the world's reaction was pretty much what the reaction was here at MU and in Columbia when Sam announced that he was gay earlier this year.
Everyone knew that this was going to happen, that the likelihood of him getting drafted. Actually, they thought that he might have been drafted higher than round 7, but it happened almost toward the end of the draft, and I think there was some speculation as to whether or not he was going to get drafted as the clock kept ticking. And so when this happened, I think that, you know, there was not much of a surprise. I think the surprise was how long ESPN stayed with that shot. And some people have criticized ESPN for staying with it that long until you get the ultimate kiss.
And it was well more than a minute.
It was well more than a minute. And the fact that ESPN has continued to play that clip, that part of the clip, mm-hmm. over and over and over again. And there's been some criticism about that.
It wasn't an accident. I mean, they devoted several minutes of their planning meeting to just talking about how they were going to handle this if he was drafted. They obviously had a camera there. But what I thought was kind of interesting is that the person who was producing the NFL draft coverage for ESPN,
Seth Markman
is a younger guy and has a younger crew. And he said, I don't understand people thinking about the kiss being controversial. He said, you know, quite honestly, it was just another moment in the year for us. And so, you know, I think maybe that says something about the generational change and why this wasn't a big deal for some members of the ESPN crew.
I mean, mean, I think it says a lot about the generational differences between maybe what you see in terms of those who are planning these events and the on-air talent, because there was a lot of conversation among the on-air talent about whether or not ESPN did the right thing in showing that. Some said yes, some said no, and then you have others who say, okay, you show it, that's fine, but to continue to show it and generate this sort of controversy about that moment is probably a little bit much.
Didn't you think it was interesting to see how quickly that some folks reacted officially when players or former players, you know, came out and criticized the kiss? I mean, a player for the Miami Dolphins,
he was
penalized for it by his coach, and he had to come on and basically apologize after the fact for what he said.
Well, I think that there are a lot of people that are surprised about that. I'm not surprised, because the NFL is a brand. And if you have players, coaches, administrators who bring controversy, negative controversy, right, to the brand, then they're going to be penalized right away by the NFL. And I think that has a lot to do with what happened with Miami. And that Miami has its own history, right, of intolerance. Last year you had several players, including some starters, mm-hmm, who were involved in serious bullying incidents that caused one player to leave the team. So Miami, I think Miami just jumped at it right away and said, wait a minute, we're not going to even deal with this right now.
I think it's really interesting, too, how both Sam and his new coach now, Jeff Fisher, were responding to media coverage. I mean, Fisher was, you know, he was prepared, obviously, for it. They'd talked about it before they made the pick. And he's been focusing both during the draft day and yesterday when they brought Michael Sam in front of the cameras for the first time in St. Louis. And he was very professional about it. Yes, we talked about it in our meetings, but this is about him being a good football player. And, you know, Sam tried to say the same thing. I mean, of course, he wants to say that he's representing of the gay community, and he wants to help anybody going through these same kind of problems. But he knows he's not going to be a role model or anything else if he doesn't make the team.
He's got to make the team. That's got to be the focus now.
And I think that the Rams did a masterful job of handling this. They basically said, look, we're going to make him available tomorrow, just Michael Sam, to deal with these issues. But once he's done with this, it's about football. We're gonna look at him as a football player, and he's going to have the opportunity to make this team as a football player. So I think the way they handled it and their approach to it is pretty good. And I think that this is probably the right team.
Yeah.
In terms of Michael Sam being able to make an NFL roster.
There was some media speculation about whether or not the Rams were really putting themselves that much out there. Seventh round pick, if he doesn't make the team, no big deal. But there were other people who were saying, you know, I think that they made this choice realizing that he was going to get a chance to play for a little
bit. I think you're absolutely right. I think that's they chose him because of his football talent and not necessarily as we're going to take one for the team, for the NFL team, and use our draft pick to do this.
And in terms of business, Amy, at least initially, and this stuff is going to play out over several months, but Michael Sam's jersey, even though he doesn't have a real number
selling
yet,
out now,
right?
Yeah.
And the second best-selling jersey from the draft, you know, after Johnny Manziel. So I think that's a pretty good initial start for him on the business
side. We'll be watching all summer, see what happens come August. Students are always asking me, how long should my stories be? How long is too long? Usually I tell them, ask someone else to read it, listen, watch, and tell them the exact point where their eyes glaze over. When you've lost your audience, it's too long. Apparently, that's not a good rule of thumb anymore, at least not at the Associated Press or Reuters. The wire services have issued mandates to their reporters that stories should be brief, between 300 and 500 words. What's the thinking behind this?
Well, from reading all the reports that have come out on it, they're basically saying that part of it is that newspapers don't have the editing staffs that they once had, so they've had to cut back in that area, and they don't have as much time to edit the stories down. So if AP reporters, AP editors, can send stories that are shorter, that cuts down on the amount of time that the editing staffs that these newspapers do have can spend on working with those stories. Now, personally, I think that is an issue, but even more so than that, I think this is an impact of both the economy on newspapers, especially on legacy newspapers, and the internet. I think the way in which people get their news and information and how much time they spend with it had something to do with the AP making this decision.
Yeah, and I think it just makes sense, truthfully, in the media environment we're in. I mean, and let's be clear. Not all stories have to be 300 to 500 words. Investigative pieces can be longer. The top stories of the day can be longer.
These are basically the digest type stories, right. Things that might run as a brief in a newspaper anyway.
The AP and Reuters are just being realistic. I mean, this is what today's audiences want. This is what today's news clients, the newspapers and broadcasters who buy their content from the AP and Reuters, this is what they want. And that makes sense to me. The people who are moaning about, well, this is, there was a time when, the length of the story was determined by how good the story was and what the reporter had to say. When we had the luxury of making the kinds of profits we were making, especially on the newspaper side, okay. But, broadcasters have been living with a minute 30 or 45 seconds or whatever for a long time, and they've still been able to tell good stories.
And that's a templated time. If you needed more time than that, you would have to ask before you went out and did your reporting, before you went out and did the writing to negotiate for that time. I'm sorry to
cut you off. I also think that what's happening here is that you've got a generation of not only people who are producing the news, but also people who are consuming it, who want that conciseness. They want those stories to be concise. Get to the point. Tell me the information that I need to know and how it's going to benefit me. And I think that in this format, you can give the audience what it wants. And I also think that you can also help a lot of our young writers to be better at their craft.
And by the way, I mean, I still love a good long-form read, and I know there are lots of people who do, not so many younger people, but lots of people who do. But, if you're going to do a long-form story today, you've got to make it really compelling, and it can't often be just words. It has to have the multimedia. It has to have some sort of enhanced social media built into it, or people are just not going to stick around for it.
I mean, you're going to have those stories that call for a lot of information, because that the public's going to need that in order to be able to understand it. But the types of stories that AP is saying that they're holding this standard to are the ones that we see on a regular everyday basis, state house reporting, some legislative stuff, that sort of thing.
So you think we're still going to see some of those longer form pieces like we saw from Reuters earlier this year on international adoptions and some of those that have gone wrong? We're still going to see that.
I think you're going to see that. You're going to have to see that in order to be able to give the public the information that it needs. I mean, there are some critical stories out there when you talk about healthcare, when you talk about the economy. When you talk about the environment and what's going on in the environment, those long-form stories give you that information, that depth and breadth that's necessary.
And so you need those kind of stories if you're going to invest the time to tell them, but they also have to be stories that can be marketable so that the AP or Reuters can charge a premium for those stories because their client newspapers or broadcasters or online news sources can charge more for advertising around them.
So while we're talking about charging for a premium for digital content, let me ask you this. What is a digital journalist worth? Ask any of us who work primarily online, and we'd like to say that we're worth as much as any other journalist, but unfortunately, that's not always the case. And it led to a byline strike at Canada's largest daily newspaper, the Toronto Star. Last Wednesday, articles ran in the paper with Star staff as the only credit in protest of a plan to hire 17 digital editors at a salary 40% less than editors working on the print edition. This is, unfortunately, a trend we are seeing, isn't it?
And it's a trend that we've been seeing for a while.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a purely economic decision that was made by the owners of that paper. Now, I can also understand what the reporters and the writers are thinking, because they have a union contract and they're concerned about whether or not their wages are going to be their wages are going to depreciate because of this. Because if you're bringing in digital journalists at a lower rate, then eventually those reporters who are on the writing side, if they're transitioning over to digital, are concerned that their wages are going to drop. So, I mean, it's something that's began happening in the U.S. I would say over 10, 15 years ago, and now you're starting to see it migrate in other areas.
Yeah, I agree completely with Ernest. I mean, I think what's really at play here, I mean, the union does care that these younger journalists or digital journalists are being paid less. But it's not really about the Toronto Star devaluing, digital journalists. What's going to happen is, as he says, salary – this is the wedge. This is the opportunity for the paper and other papers with unionized staffs to bring down the wages of everybody.
And I think that part of it is the fact that what's going on here is that their revenue is down. Advertising revenue from that particular unit, because the overall parent company, they're making money. But what's happening is that they're not generating the profits that they used to generate from that newspaper. And it's basically what's been happening in legacy media, especially newspapers, for over a decade.
This next story could be good or could be bad, depending on what side you come down on when it comes to privacy issues. It was definitely a blow to Google, that's for sure. A European Union court ruled that the tech giant must amend some of its search results at the request of ordinary citizens. The case was brought by a man in Spain who complained an online notice for an auction of his repossessed home infringed on his privacy when that continued to come up in search results for his name. As journalists, we're looking for those types of things to come up when we're backgrounding a source, when we're trying to look into somebody's history or kind of see what's going on there. But as private citizens, we can kind of relate to this guy.
I understand the truly private citizen, sort of the average Joe or Jane, worrying about all this information being out there forever and searchable. I get that. And I understand, too, why European citizens, given the media coverage of what we have done, the U.S. and spying on them, I can understand there's even more sensitivity in the EU. That being said, the European Union is pretty regulatory happy, let's put it that way, compared to the U.S. And what really bothers me is not whether or not these average Joe Blow citizens can ask for information to be removed. I do think that's problematic, at least technically. But what I'm worried about, talk about wedges in the last story we're talking about, what happens when the famous person, when the newsmaker, the public figure demands to have content?
The celebrity.
Well, like news stories they don't like anymore being removed.
Or this a kind French of prime minister who French may or may not be involved in shenanigans.
Exactly. I mean, what happens when he leaves office? You know,
and claims private citizenry.
Exactly. And then all of a sudden he goes to Google and say, hey, I want you to take down everything that you've ever written about me. This opens up a Pandora's box for those people to be able to go in and do that. And what I'm looking at is, OK, Google's going to spend more money and more time trying to take things down than to actually enhance its usability among its customers. And that's going to have an impact on its bottom line.
It's interesting that at least immediately after the decision was announced that it didn't have an impact on Google's bottom line.
Really,
I mean, their stock price was not affected at all. But I do think it points to a larger problem that we've talked about on the show before, and that's how do multinational information-based companies like Google that are based in the United States deal with all the different laws that countries that are maybe not quite – have at least a different understanding of what, you know, right to know or information privacy is than we do. How do they deal with all those different
laws? It's going to be very interesting because the decision that was made – by over in the EU is according to legal scholars, is a violation of the First Amendment in this country. So, I mean, it's going to be interesting to see how do they deal with that. I mean, do you get a different Google in the EU than you get in the United States?
We have a different Google in China than we have in the United States, for example.
Yeah.
And you know, the thing that really also bothered me besides the obvious issue of censorship is when the court – this is what they said, how they were going to determine whether or not Google or any other search engine had to remove stuff. If it appeared to be, quote, inadequate, irrelevant, or no longer – who gets to decide that?
Yeah, who gets to decide that? I mean, does the plaintiff, the person that wants their information taken out, do they get to make that decision? Does it go before a court? They're going to want that information to come down immediately. Does Google get to make has the right to say, well, wait a minute, we think that this is in public domain and it should remain?
Or do a bunch of bureaucrats get to decide?
Exactly. Now you got legislation over several years. I mean, it's going to be very confusing to actually, you know, number one, mandate this, and then number two, to enforce it. I think that's where the problem is going to come.
Well, and one of the things, too, that Google has maintained through this entire process is that it's not collecting information. It's not harboring this information. It's not holding the information. It's simply making information that's already out there visible.
Yeah.
And that's the defense that the company is using for why it doesn't think it's doing anything wrong. We're not doctors and we don't play them on TV or on the radio. And because we don't always understand the intricacies of medical science, our reporting isn't always as accurate as it could be when it comes to health and fitness related stories. That's according to a study published this week in the Journal of the American Medical Association's Internal Medicine Journal. Just how bad is it, according to this study?
the study basically says that on about half of the measures that they use to determine quality of medical coverage, that most stories fail. And they looked for 7 years at, what, a couple of thousand stories from print, online, broadcast. So it was a pretty good sample. And I have to say, from reading the study in the JAMA, I tend to agree with them. Now, let's just say up front that scientists, and especially medical scientists, are always distrustful of journalists. I know a lot of them that won't talk to journalists, and they think the answer, some of them think the answer is that we just publish whatever they say are right verbatim. That's never going to happen. It's our job to interpret.
The study actually confirmed that a lot of these stories are based solely on press releases.
Press releases are one source stories, in essence, basically,
we are just regurgitating what they're saying.
But often those press releases are also being distilled by PR staffs. The scientists want us to just take their answers, run their answers as long as it takes for them to explain. And so that is not something that we can do. But on the other hand, journalists also think that they don't really have a lot to learn about science, and they do. So there's plenty of education that needs to occur on both
sides. And I think that's the key, is education. I think that journalists are going to have to do a better job of understanding the areas in which they're going to be doing the reporting and what questions to ask. What information are you seeking? And then think about, how can I relay that to the public? Because oftentimes when you see these things, they talk about, well, coffee is going to lead to heart problems, or
and then
wine.
2 weeks from now, it's actually going to strengthen your heart.
Exactly. and so when people are just getting the taglines or the headlines, and they're just seeing just the lead, that doesn't really tell the full story. And I think that's where journalists have some culpability on this.
Yeah, I think we ought to see just a little bit about some of the actual points they found. And you've linked to the entire
piece on the blog.
Right. That's really cool. But here's one, for example. They say that journalists tend to frame their stories when they're talking about benefits almost entirely in a positive light. No skepticism involved. We hardly ever talk about the limitations of the studies or the research that were done. And we often base them, as you said, on press releases, or at best, one interview with one scientist, the person who made the discovery or was the lead.
And sometimes
researcher.
It's not even a scientist. Yeah. It's somebody who actually
a
works.
Drug company, a drug or somebody that has something to benefit. Yeah. The last point that was in the list of things that journalists tend to do poorly that really stood out to me here, being in mid-Missouri where we have a medical school where there's a lot of research going on, was the idea that there tends to be a lot of focus on local researchers or on businesses that could stand to benefit locally. Yeah. How do we get outside of our own communities in this kind of reporting too?
Well, I think part of it is that, you know, I think the reason you're seeing a lot of that is the whole economic part of it. And that's where they're going. But I think you really have to get with the scientists, because they're not only working with scientists here, they're working with scientists somewhere else. So we need to also be interviewing the scientists who are at other places who are doing similar research, or not comparative research, but complementary research on that.
So having said that, can I be a homer for just a second?
Absolutely.
So I think we are doing some interesting things on campus here. Yeah. And for example, over at the Bond Life Sciences Center, every year they sponsor a science communication forum. This year they had Bill Nye, the science guy, there. They had the journalist who wrote The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lack. And there's also a plan underway. I know there are lots of folks talking about it in the J School and among scientists on this campus to actually build a more lasting program around science communication so that journalists and scientists can do a better job. I'm hoping that that becomes reality sometime soon.
So even with the Homerism there, it's showing how, as Ernest was saying, we need to work at educating journalists better to be able to see all sides of it and bring more depth into it. Well, for more than 50 years, Barbara Walters has been a fixture on network television, first on NBC and then moving to ABC in the mid-70s. For decades, she's paved the way for women in broadcast journalism, fighting for equal pay to her male counterparts and becoming the first woman to hold the title of co-host on a network news program. Barbara Walters is beloved by many. After all, some say being a comic's punchline is the highest form of flattery.
Good evening, and welcome to Not for Waities Only. I'm Barbara Wawa.
If you were a man, I'd be all over you like butter on beans.
And let me tell everyone here, Mariah Carey is even more vivacious in 3D.
I was in a hot tub with Henry Kissinger and Juliet Prowse. We speculated about our nation's future, listened to some Harry Chapin, and then made sweet love to the morning sun.
Those clips are all from Saturday Night Live, of course. Walters appeared on the show this past week as part of its tribute to her. Here she is during the Weekend Update segment.
It is fine to make people smile, but the real money is in making them cry. Nothing brings in the viewers like seeing a celebrity reduced to tears. You may think, oh, I'm really feeling bad for them, but all I'm thinking is, ka-ching.
It's all fun and games until someone gets hurt, or that is, someone makes Walters cry. It happened on The View, the daytime talk show that she created in 1997. Friday, a longtime friend and Walters interview subject Bette Midler joined the women of The View, paying tribute with a song.
You gotta win a little, lose a little, and always have the blues a little. That's the story of, that's the glory of love. That's the story of, that's the glory of love. Oh,
someone had to do it, and Bette Midler starting the tradition of helping talk show hosts generation after generation sign off. I'm sure there's going to be at least one more tear shed before the end of the week. But in all seriousness, let's talk a little bit about the legacy Barbara Walters is going to leave behind.
Well, I think the legacy that needs to be remembered is the groundbreaking legacy of opening doors for women in broadcast news. And
I'm sitting here as a result.
Yeah. The one thing that I'm afraid of as a historian is that some of that is going to be lost because of what she's done on The View and some of the other programs. But it was really the fact that she was one of the first hard-hitting newswomen who were out there breaking barriers. And she did a very good job of that.
I mean, all these send-offs are sweetness and light, but you have to remember that she was the subject of a lot of discrimination and harsh reactions from her male counterparts. I mean, Harry Reasoner, when she was teamed up with her, with him rather, as a co-anchor on ABC's nightly broadcast, I mean, he tried everything he could to bring her down. And she had to deal with a lot so that other women wouldn't have to put up with so much.
Right. And it's going to be – it's very interesting. You're starting to see it now as the tributes from a lot – including yourself, a lot of women who got into broadcasting because of what she did and the barriers she broke down. And it's very interesting that she has built her own legacy, not just as a news person, but also in some ways as a superstar news person.
And I can say that, all humor aside, she has been one of the great television interviewers. I mean, maybe she reduces people to tears. Maybe she asks people whether they're a tree or not. But she's a great interviewer.
The heart of it. Right. Yeah. You don't reach that level of emotion with some of these people that she's interviewing if you aren't asking the questions that really get to the heart of who they are and to the depth of what it is that makes them special.
And I think it's something that you don't see in very many newscasters now is the ability to do that, the ability to really hit home on those questions.
Well, as a historian and as professors, we're going to have to make sure that we are instilling her legacy on generations to come. That music means we're pretty much out of time for this week. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about the topics we talked about today on our links blog. Find it under the programs tab at kbia.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @views on KBIA. They're all great ways to watch our show again, leave comments for us, questions, and see what we'll be talking about next week. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing and to Pat Akers for handling the audio. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to join us again next week when we're back with you for another edition of Views of the News.